VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. Ousted Syrian President Bashar al-Assad said he had no plans to leave the country after the fall of Damascus a week ago, but the Russian military evacuated him after their base in western Syria came under attack. Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan reports.
A statement published on Monday on the Syrian presidency's Telegram channel was posted from Moscow, where Assad has been granted asylum. It said he wanted to address distortions given during a critical juncture in the nation's history, and at no point did he consider stepping down, seeking refuge, or did he receive a proposal from an individual party. He was ousted after insurgent forces led by the Islamist Hayat Tahrir al-Sham swept through Syria in a lightning offensive, ending more than 50 years of iron-fisted rule by his family. Assad wrote that he left Damascus to manage combat operations from Humayman base in Latakia on December 8, but after it came under drone attack, Moscow requested the base's command arrange an immediate evacuation to Russia. President Vladimir Putin made the decision to grant Assad asylum in Russia, which deployed its air force to Syria in 2015 to help him repel rebel forces.
Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan. Ukraine's military intelligence agency and U.S. military officials say some North Korean troops have been killed during combat against Ukrainian forces in Russia's Kursk border region. These are the first reported casualties since the U.S. and Ukraine announced North Korea had sent 10,000 to 12,000 troops to Russia to help it in the almost three-year war. The Ukrainian agency said Monday that around 30 North Korean troops were killed or wounded over the weekend during battle in Kursk, where Russia has for months been trying to quash a Ukrainian incursion. This is VOA News. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump on Monday held his first news conference since winning last month's election. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
From considering a pardon for New York's embattled mayor to suspected drone sightings in the eastern U.S.
Our military knows and our president knows. And for some reason, they want to keep people in suspense.
Trump backed his pick, a prominent vaccine skeptic, Robert Kennedy, for health secretary.
He's going to be much less radical than you would think.
And vowed to preserve access to a key vaccine.
You're not going to lose the polio vaccine. That's not going to happen.
He's calling on President Biden to stop following Congress's directive to sell unused border wall parts.
It's almost a criminal act.
Threatening more defamation suits against media organizations.
Our press is very corrupt.
And defending trade proposals many economists say would hurt Americans.
Tariffs will make our country rich.
On the Middle East,
we had a very good talk
with Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu about ending the Gaza war. But as for Russia and Ukraine,
I see that as more difficult.
Backing off earlier promises to end the fighting before even taking office. Sagar Magani, Washington.
TikTok on Monday asked the U.S. Supreme Court to step in on an emergency basis to block the federal law that would ban the popular platform in the United States unless its China-based parent company agreed to sell it. AP correspondent Norman Hall reports.
Lawyers for the company and China-based ByteDance urged the justices to step in before the law's Thursday deadline. President-elect Donald Trump was asked if he will keep his pledge to save the platform.
You know, I have a warm spot in my heart for TikTok because I won youth by 34 points.
If the ban takes effect, it would expose app stores that offer TikTok and internet hosting services that support it to potential fines. Norman Hall, Washington.
Canada's finance minister quit on Monday, dealing another major political blow to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's already unpopular government. Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino reports.
Chrystia Freeland said in a stinging resignation letter that she was quitting in the wake of a meeting last Friday with Trudeau, who had asked her to take on a lesser post after the two had argued for weeks over spending. In a letter posted to social media, Freeland said the possibility of new U.S. tariffs represented a grave threat. She joins a wave of cabinet ministers who have either already quit or announced they won't run in the next election.
Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 17th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Human Rights Watch accuses Sudan's rapid support forces of rape against women and girls.
In this new report of Human Rights Watch, we have included details that we gathered into the cases of 79 women and girls who were raped by the RSF, including girls as young as 7 years old.
Sudan's conflict increases pressure on South Sudan to aid amputees and other left with disabilities. Uganda's president comes under criticism for trying civilians in military courts. Zambia's government defends its record in the fight against corruption. Candidates for African Union chairmanship debate international issues of importance to the continent.
They decided to do some type of rotation to make sure that one region doesn't dominate. And this year, they decided that the East African community deserves a shot.
And U.S. farmers hope that Donald Trump's pick for Secretary of Agriculture will guide important tariff and farm bill legislation. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Human Rights Watch has accused Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces and allied militias of rape and other acts of sexual violence against women and girls in South Kordofan State. The rights group says sexual violence constitutes war crimes and that it underscores the urgent need for an international action to protect Sudanese civilians and develop justice to the victims. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
Human Rights Watch says representatives met with raped or sexually abused women in Sudan's South Kordofan State during their visit this past October. The women from the Nuba minority ethnic group say they were violated and exploited by members of Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces and allied militias. The RSF was not available to respond to the allegations against its fighters. Belkis Will is an associate director in the Crisis, Conflict and Armed Division at Human Rights Watch.
In this new report of Human Rights Watch, we have included details that we gathered into the cases of 79 women and girls who were raped by the RSF, including girls as young as 7 years old. And indeed, we also documented the case of a group of 51 women and girls who were taken by the RSF and held on a military base and used as sex slaves for months.
The survivors and witnesses told investigators that they had been gang raped since December 2023, and some of the victims were still missing. Local and international rights groups have documented many alleged human rights violations by both the RSF and the Sudanese armed forces since the sides went to war in April 2023, battling for power and control of the country. Hala Al-Karib is a regional director of the Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa. She says RSF is known to use sexual violence against communities to drive them out of their homes.
Most of the families and communities who were forced to leave their homes in Sudan, in Khartoum or Al Jazeera, on territories that's under the control of the RSF, you know, people were left because of sexual violence. So it's used as a land-grabbing tool. It's used to break communities' capacity to resist. And it's used also to control communities and to spread fears.
The International Criminal Court in The Hague issued an arrest warrant in 2009 against former President Omar al-Bashir and some commanders of militia groups on allegations of genocide, war crimes and crimes against humanity in the Darfur region. Experts say the failure to hand over Bashir, who was ousted in 2019, is now being held at a military hospital on the outskirts of Khartoum, is one factor that is fueling the conflict in Sudan. Al-Karib says despite victims of past abuses not receiving justice, people will refuse to accept any solution that does not address the abuse and violations against them.
Demands for justice should never be silenced. This time it should be an integral part for any political process because the grievances and the pain that the communities are having is way too much. And I don't think they are going to accept a political process that will conclude without justice arrangements.
Will of Human Rights Watch says survivors and victims of sexual violence need justice and protection.
It's really important, first and foremost, for the RSF to take action against these abuses. That means investigating their own forces for carrying out incidents of rape. It means immediately releasing any women and girls that are still being held and ensuring that these kind of acts don't continue. But we do need to see leadership from other actors as well.
As the violence and suffering of Sudanese civilians continued in September, Sudan's military-led government rejected a UN plan to deploy a mission to protect civilians. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
South Sudan is grappling with an influx of people living with disabilities as victims of ongoing conflicts in neighboring countries such as Sudan come in search of devices like artificial limbs. The surge puts immense pressure on South Sudan, a nation with just 3 specialized orthopedic centers. Sheila Pony reports from Juba, South Sudan.
At just 9 years old, Lado Jackson had to learn to walk with elbow crutches after a road accident forced doctors to amputate his left leg. The incident initially turned Jackson's life upside down, leaving him unable to engage in his favorite childhood activity, football. Today, Jackson, now 23 years old, is one of South Sudan's most recognizable amputee footballers, using the crutches to move while he kicks the ball with his remaining leg.
In 2011, that is the time I started learning how to play football with one limb. And I didn't know that something exists called amputee football. So I was just thinking, I wish my leg was not amputated because I love really football so much.
Jackson received support at the Physical Rehabilitation Reference Center in Juba. The center, supported by the International Committee of the Red Cross, is not only helping South Sudanese like Jackson, but also aiding refugees fleeing civil war in Sudan. Ura Bosco is head of the Juba-based Prosthetic and Orthotic Center.
Of course, there are already clients that have already these conditions, but then their number also get bigger and bigger because of conflict, more road accidents.
One such client is Adam Ahmed Mohamud, a refugee from Sudan who received his first prosthetic leg at this center. Ahmed fled to South Sudan after his entire family was displaced from their home in Sudan's Darfur region. He says, "I was shot on both legs. One of my legs was amputated, and the other one is still not okay." Mohamud's leg was amputated at Juba Teaching and Referral Hospital before he was taken to Rehabilitation Reference Center. One of my neighbors brought me to this place and told me they would give me a new leg. That's how I got this prosthetic leg. The growing influx of refugees has placed immense strain on South Sudan's fragile health system, still recovering from its own civil war. James Ochan, a disability inclusion advisor, says the center is coping with a rising tide of patients.
So far, the data that have been registered this year, from January to October, we have 2,549.
Ochan attributes the increase to neighboring Sudan's civil war, which has intensified over the past year. Sheila Pony, VOA News, Juba, South Sudan.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 17. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Last Friday, 3 candidates vying for the chairmanship of the African Union Commission put forward some of their policy positions during a debate. The 3 are Raila Odinga of Kenya, Mahamud Ali Yusuf of Djibouti, and Richard Radramindrato of Madagascar. The election is expected to take place in February. The candidate discussed prominent seats with veto power for Africa on the UN Security Council, strengthening Africa's internal security, among other suggestions. Kweku Nuama is a professor in the School of International Service at American University in Washington, D.C. I asked him for his general assessment of the debate.
I think the debate is a public relations effort to make it look democratic, but in actual fact, that's not how the chairperson of the commission is selected. It's a purely political process because the real work is done behind the scenes.
Two of the three candidates, Odinga and Yusuf of Djibouti, they come from the East African community. If you talk about political thing, is it regionalism or how is it decided politically?
So they've decided to do some type of rotation to make sure that one region doesn't dominate. And this year they decided that the East African community deserves a shot. Since we transitioned to the African Union, East Africa and North Africa have not had a chance to nominate or to win the chairmanship. But you also have Madagascar in there, and so is the process. But I think that Raila Odinga is clearly the forerunner. He's been endorsed by, that's what he says, about 21 nations have endorsed him. And so this should be his race to win. And so really, that's how the work is done. It's done through consensus. It's done through diplomatic engagement. It's done behind the scenes.
Raila Odinga has put forward this idea of two permanent seats on the UN Security Council. It's a must, according to him. You and I, we have discussed this topic about the Security Council seat for Africa. What do you think the emphasis that Odinga is putting on it?
So I watched the debate. All of them agree on that. And again, this is not something that none of the candidates came up with this stuff. The African Union decided to push for this, and it appears as if they're going to get something there. Problem is whether they can get veto powers, which Raila was talking about, or not. I don't think that they're going to get a veto power. But you can have the two seats, and the question is whether the African Union is going to have a say in how those seats are filled. Because you remember, we already have presentation at the G20, and African Union plays a role in deciding how Africa is represented about this. And maybe this is something that the incoming chair can have an input on. But I think that the things that really, really matter are what you do within your countries, and then not what you do at the United Nations.
And I think you put your finger exactly on it. The Madagascar candidate is looking inward by calling on African countries.
That's what matters the most, internal security. And again, you and I have talked about the permanent seats. I want to see Africa represented in these forums, but there's nothing that African governments want to do for their people today that they are unable to do because we don't have a veto power in the Security Council. You can have a veto power. It's not going to impact what happens within these countries. What happens in these within these countries is based on how governments govern. So those things can be done. You don't need a veto power to do good governance, to invest in your people, to respect human rights, to not steal money from your people. You don't need a veto power for any of those things.
Kweku Nuama is the professor in the School of International Service at American University here in Washington, D.C. Rights activists in Uganda have criticized Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni's stance on the trial of civilians in military courts. They say the president is using military courts to suppress those who are opposed to his government. Reporter Mugumi Davis Rakaringi has more from Kampala.
Following the abduction and trial of Uganda opposition leader Dr. Cesar Besigye in a military court, Museveni took on social media account X, formerly Twitter, to defend his government's actions and said the decision helps expedite the judicial process. Museveni said that trying civilian suspects in military courts, notably those alleged to have committed crimes involving the use of guns, would create stability in the country. Museveni, who has been in power for close to 4 decades, said civilian courts are congested and are slow to provide justice. Isaac Semakade is a Kampala lawyer who heads the Uganda Law Society, a body responsible for ensuring professionalism among lawyers. Speaking to VOA by phone, he said the president should not have made comments that directly affect the ongoing case. He calls it, to quotes, a blatant contempt of the rule of the law.
The president and his advisors ought to know this, and they ought to have respect for court orders and court processes. So the president's letter was in bad taste. It was depressing, it was disappointing, it was shocking to those who have respect for the rule of law. The president, like any other person, should have respect, should cease and desist from making remarks that preempt ongoing court processes.
Besigye, a strong serving critic, has on several occasions been tried in courts of law for several cases, including prison, but was found not to be guilty of the charges. Some high-ranking criminal suspects, including those accused of terrorism, have been tried in civilian courts. Sara Biriete heads the local political watchdog, the Center for Constitutional Governance in Uganda. She says the president should stop using the courts of law to target his opponents, including those belonging to the opposition National Unity Platform, or NUP.
This indicates the double standards in our country, but also confirms that the military courts are now used to persecute political opposition in Uganda. And the case in point is the trial of Dr. Besigye and the trial of NUP supporters, some of whom were forced to admit to the crimes and immediately given presidential pardon.
Semakade is calling on Ugandan courts to stick the laws.
It is all in the hands of the Chief Justice. I can assure you, if the Chief Justice did not have extensive additional security, he would be the most hated Ugandan now. He owes us accountability, and the time for being patient is over. Our patience has run thin. I am under so much pressure by the community of court users to get the Chief Justice to do his duty.
Uganda's Supreme Court has on several occasions ruled against the trial of civilians in the military courts. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
In Zambia, the Director General of the National Media Committee of the ruling United Party for National Development, the UPND, says President Hakainde Hichilema is committed to the fight against corruption. Frank Bualia's remark come after the president terminated the contract of the permanent secretaries of the Ministries of Health, Foreign and Energy over corruption and inefficiency. For more on the fight against corruption, VOA's Peter Clotin reached Frank Bualia.
The fight against corruption on the part of President Dr. Hakainde Hichilema and his Newton government is something that has never been doubted by Zambians. Only those in the opposition, including the PF, would like to campaign the president by saying he was not committed to fighting corruption of today except the corruption of yesterday. Now, the permanent secretaries that have been fired of late, Zambians know very well that there have been a lot of complaints and reports about grand corruption at the Ministry of Health. However, I am hesitant to say much about that because we have to wait for law enforcement agencies to act on whatever reports the president may have, and those matters, for sure, will have to go to court. If some of them will be arrested, they will have to be proven guilty or indeed to be acquitted. So we may have more to say at that stage than today.
The president's critics are saying that if he was committed to the fight against corruption and inefficiencies and incompetencies, he could have put measures in place to prevent people from engaging in such acts, and that his decision to fire these people appears to be the same way previous administrations have fought corruption when reports of wrongdoing are brought in the press.
The system is in place to deter people from engaging in corruption, to deter people from incompetence and irresponsible work. The system is in place. But that would not stop people from being corrupt. So when they are found wanting, the president comes in to fire them, the law enforcement agencies come in to arrest such people and ensure that they are prosecuted. So the fact that some people have engaged themselves in corruption, you cannot blame the president. The president can only be blamed if he does nothing about it.
So where do you think the fight against corruption is currently?
There's a lot of propaganda coming out of the opposition claiming that some development partners of Zambia withheld their support to Zambia, specifically to the Minister of Health. Much of what we are hearing in that space are just lies. This government has performed far, far much better than the previous regime. And it has only been in government for 3 years and a few months. So the cleaning up is not yet over.
Frank Bualia is the Director General of the National Media Committee of Zambia's ruling United Party for National Development Party. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty. France is rushing rescue workers and supplies to its Indian Ocean territory of Mayotte after the island group of Africa was battered by its worst cyclone in nearly a century. The Associated Press says authorities feared hundreds and possibly thousands of people died when Cyclone Chido leveled neighborhoods on Saturday. U.S. farmers hope that President-elect Donald Trump's selection to head the U.S. Department of Agriculture will understand their concerns while guiding trade policy and farm legislation. Viewers Ken Fairbaugh has more from Chicago.
Henry County, Illinois farmer Steve Nightingale and hundreds more from the statewide agricultural community gathered at the Illinois Farm Bureau's annual meeting this month in Chicago to discuss the path forward amid uncertainty about U.S. trade policy.
The farm economy is not great right now. The potential for tariffs, the combination of those two make any decision, you know, gets you a little nervous.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture's forecasts for 2024 show farmers across the United States losing nearly a quarter of their net farm income compared to the 2022 peak, while prices for inputs like fertilizer are near all-time highs. Nightingale is concerned about further economic turmoil if social media posts by President-elect Donald Trump outlining tariffs on some U.S. trading partners become policy.
When other countries retaliate against us, they go after the bread and butter, which is agriculture.
Nightingale, the president of the Henry County Farm Bureau, hopes Trump's pick to head the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Brooke Rollins, understands his concerns about tariffs and the importance of passing a new farm bill to replace one that expired earlier this year.
We were kind of surprised because her name was never on any of the lists that we were seeing.
David Eiserman farms outside Streeter, Illinois, in LaSalle County, one of the top corn and soybean producing counties in the country.
She doesn't really have that background that some of the other ag secretaries have had, but that doesn't mean she'll be a bad one, so we'll just have to wait and see.
Rollins, who served in the previous Trump administration as the acting director of the White House Domestic Policy Council, graduated from Texas A&M University with a degree in agricultural management.
So she's got some ag background, and hopefully she's going to come in with an open mind and be supportive of farmers, and she said she is.
Eiserman is also trying to have an open mind about transforming U.S. trade policy.
And until he takes office, until the new president takes office, we're really not going to know what's going to happen. But I know we've heard he's had talks with Canada, and supposedly those were productive. So maybe it's working in the case of Canada.
I just don't want an agriculture model that's built on government policy.
Dan Miller is the CEO of Steward, which crowdsources investors, connecting them with farmers and other producers. Miller says tariffs may encourage greater diversity in what U.S. farmers grow and where they sell it, shifting from reliance on exporting corn and soybeans to increased production of other crops.
A model that's built on huge amount of policy and government support, most farmers I work with would prefer not to have that. They're just stuck in it. You know, they grow corn and soy because they can drop it at the elevator and get paid.
Miller acknowledges shifting production of any crop is a lengthy, expensive, and complicated process requiring new infrastructure, but hopes debate about tariffs and U.S. agricultural policy allows for policy to shift.
We just want a free market.
While Nightingale wants new buyers for corn and soybean crops, Eiserman would settle for more certainty in U.S. trade and agricultural policy.
We're using us as a pawn, agriculture as a pawn, and that concerns me.
Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Chicago.
And that's it for this Tuesday, December 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton, Washington, saying thank you for listening. We'll